Well, shortly before we came on air, we heard that tonight's performance at the Abbey Theatre, a new play by Sean O'Casey, had been drowned out by protests during the first acts. The play is called The Plough and the Stars, and it is the third in Mr. O'Casey's series of plays about nationalism and poverty in Dublin. It opened earlier this week and had apparently been well received till tonight. Well, we sent John Murray to the theatre to find out what was happening, and he's on the line now. John, what's the situation there at the Abbey at the moment?
Well, Colin, half a dozen detectives of the Gardaí Síochána have just arrived, and they've succeeded in calming things down somewhat for the moment. The play was stopped shortly after I arrived. I hadn't been able to hear anything. There was absolute pandemonium in the audience.
John, why did they stop the play?
There was just a lot of shouting and heckling from the audience during the first two acts, and then suddenly a group of women with some men in tow surged from the audience, and some of them climbed up on the piano in the orchestral pit and used it to get on stage from there.
What did the actors do about that, John?
Well, they actually tried to stop them. The actor Barry Fitzgerald, he gave one ferocious blow to the chin, which sent one protester flying back into the audience, and he wasn't on his own. His colleague Sheila Richards pulled at the hair of one of the women protesters until she relented and fled the stage.
John, what about backstage? Have you had a chance to step behind the curtain, as it were?
Interestingly enough, Colin, when the curtain came down, I went around the back just in time to see Senator W.B. Yeats arriving.
He must have been very anxious.
Well,
Yeats.
Not at all. In fact, he looked like he was thoroughly enjoying himself. He decided he'd get up and address the crowd, so he actually gave a signal to the man operating the curtain, and suddenly it rose suddenly dramatically, and Yeats appeared at the centre of the stage, and I actually managed to get the recorder out and record that.
You have disgraced yourselves again. Is this going to be the recurring celebration of Irish genius? Sing first and then O'Casey. The news of the happenings of the last few minutes here will fly from country to country. Dublin has once more rocked the cradle of a reputation. From such a scene in this theatre went forth the name of Singh. Equally the fame of O'Casey is born here tonight.
John, have you managed to talk to any of the protesters or to get any sense of why they're so upset about O'Casey's play?
They're essentially a group of women from Cumann na mBan, and with them some of the widows and mothers of men who were killed 10 years ago in the Easter Rising. There were also people in the audience. They were more upset by the presence of a lady of the night, let's call her, on stage. A character, I think, in the play is called Rosie Redmond. Colin, I'm going to have to leave you now. The curtain is being raised and play is about to restart, so we'll have to keep voices down here. So
John, I hope you managed to actually hear the final act, and thanks very much for that. I'm joined by the writer Colm Tobin and Chris Morash, Professor of English at NUI Maynooth. Colm Tobin, it's February 1926. Tell me about the Abbey Theatre.
Yeah, it was almost seen as a sort of cauldron of how the state might see itself in the future. Lady Gregory and Yeats at Independence had offered it to the state. The state very cleverly had said, no, we won't take it, but we'll subsidise it. They were lucky in a way with Lady Gregory and Yeats. Lady Gregory and Yeats had seen off Miss Horniman, who was the initial sort of funder of the theatre. But they were lucky also in a way that Singh had died, because Singh despised both of their work for the theatre. He had no time for Yeats's plays or Lady Gregory's plays. And he was jealous of the way they were always putting them on. And once he died, of course, they could take him over and take over his legacy and make claims for having influenced him, especially Yeats, more than he indeed ever had. And because Yeats was away so much and was so deeply famous, Lady Gregory had much more power at this time and was coming from Cool more regularly and was really running the theatre. One of her proudest possessions was Sean O'Casey. Both of them were Protestants, and they were Protestants from a very different class of Protestant. But they were brought up on the Bible, both of them, and they believed in the same sort of things. They believed certainly that people could improve, and they believed in the theatre as a way of doing that. And they believed also in freedom of speech. Lady Gregory was terribly proud of having brought this young man, who had been at one time illiterate, you know, and had no chance in life, to being on his way to becoming a world-class playwright and famous all over the world. And she was very close to him, and he also to her. They put on Shadow of a Gunman, and suddenly they discovered something that also disturbed Yeats. that people were flocking to see these plays in vast numbers. And it was not the sort of poetic theatre which Yeats had in mind for the Abbey. But nonetheless, there it was. It was actually filling seats and making the theatre famous and giving the theatre a sort of role in the country. So it wasn't as though there were no tensions between these people. For example, while Yeats was, he was a senator and in the Civil War had certainly supported the Michael Collins side, Lady Gregory really had reverence for De Valera. They were not a unit. And it was always open to one or the other of them, you know, taking power, using power. And in the middle was the writer.
We're joined also by Chris Morash from NUI Maynooth. Chris, was the Abbey at this stage that thing called a national theatre?
Well, it was, and it took great pride in the fact that it was, I mean, as Yeats claimed, the world's first English-language state-subsidised theatre. It had received a subsidy in August of 1925. So just before the riots, the theatre had taken the government's money. And this was a major factor. I mean, in lots of ways, I think these riots are a kind of perfect storm. The figure who was behind the subsidy was Ernest Blythe, who would subsequently, of course, become director of the Abbey. But Blythe was intensely hated by a lot of Republicans at the time because he had been involved with the Boundary Commission.
The Boundary Commission has just reported, hasn't it?
The Boundary Commission has just reported. It's 3 years after the end of the Civil War. And it's 1926. It's 10 years after 1916. I mean, this would be like putting on a play that dealt with 9/11 today in New York, in which you had firemen who are cavorting with prostitutes.
Was the 10th anniversary a big deal? Was it well marked?
It was, and it was important in a number of ways. Within a few weeks after the riots, Sinn Féin held its Ardèche, at which it decided, which De Valera decided to go into electoral politics. So he's in a very delicate position because he has to bring his hardliners with him and at the same time make this transition and concede the point that they're actually going to sit in the Dáil. In some ways, the riots were a way of the hardliners having their say, maintaining their visibility.
And on the other side, there was an old Protestant idea that came out arrogantly and came out in very interesting ways. Yeats saying, for example, this time when we call the police, it will be their own police, as opposed to the Playboy time.
O'Casey, by this stage, then, he was a well-established, very popular playwright, or even a populist playwright for the Abbey.
What I said earlier was a perfect storm. Popular with audiences, deeply unpopular inside the Abbey itself. The week after the Abbey received its subsidy, he submitted the text of The Plough and the Stars, and the Abbey was at that time staging a production of Shaw's Arms and the Man, which was directed by Michael J. Dolan. On the opening night, O'Casey went into the green room and proceeded to tell the actors. First of all, he sat there with his head in his hands, and they said, "Well, what's wrong?" And he proceeded to tell them in great detail what was wrong with the play, and he basically berated them. I mean, you don't do that. You don't go into a green room and tell the actors what they've done wrong. And when he was finally eventually thrown out of the theatre, he went home and wrote Dolan a 1,200-word letter telling him what was wrong with the production. Now, the Abbey's a rep company. These are the actors that he's going to have to work with in his play.
O'Casey was not popular either with the people who had fought in the rebellion. He had fallen out, really, with the Nationalists a few years before 1916, having been close to them, so he knew them. And he obviously believed in Labour, and he deeply disagreed with... He thought someone like Pierce was insane. He had particular contempt for someone like Maud Gonne. He called her the Colonel's daughter. And he generally was wandering around Dublin, and by 1926 was a very powerful person wandering around Dublin, with a great number of enemies and a great amount to say.
So he sends his play into the Abbey directors. They agree to put it on. What happens then, Chris Morris?
This is just after the Abbey's been given its subsidy. So there's a change in the dynamic in the Abbey as to who holds power, because there's this government appointee, George O'Brien, who's an economist. O'Brien sees it that it's his duty to protect that subsidy. And so when they start to look at the play, there are things like the prostitute. There's language, there's words like lousy and bum and so on that are, you know, you can't say.
And there's Pierce.
And there's Pierce, yeah, in the midst of all this. Mm-hmm. And so O'Brien, he feels that there's going to be a problem with this.
So the question is he trying to protect the theatre, or is he acting as sort of an agent of...
He was a very cautious man. He was that beginning of that Free State figure who just wanted things to be quiet and good and go back to being peaceful, dealing, as you said, with these people who were all ready for a big fight.
Absolutely.
I have actually I have one of his letters that he wrote to Yeats and Lady Gregory here, and he lists his objections. He objects to the introduction of the prostitute. The lady's professional side is unduly emphasised in her actions and conversation. other objections are towards Jesus and Christ occur frequently. The vituperative vocabulary of some characters occasionally runs away with itself. The word bitch occurs on Act 1, page 15, Act 3, page 4, and Act 4, page 17. I think this should be altered. I mean, they must have found it difficult to know whether to take it seriously.
It must have been difficult for them having a Catholic in that position on the board. They simply wouldn't have been used to it. With someone speaking in that way about changing things. This is Yeats and Lady Gregory. From Mukasey's point of view, this was red rag. This was an apse. This was exactly who he loathed more. I mean, he loathed Mulgan. He loathed Pierce. But by God, did he loathe suburban Dubliners of that sort. Mm. You know, in other words, he was a serious radical. But he was also, by this time, becoming very famous, and especially famous in London. So he had another element in his armour, as it were, which was London. And he was also in a slightly odd position that none of the actresses would go out with him. And he was crazy about girls. And he wanted a wife. He wanted a girlfriend, you know. Yeah. And so that he wasn't just nosing around the Abbey insulting the actors. He was desperate trying to get off with one of the actresses.
How old was he at the stage?
He was in his 40s. Yeah. And he was too old for all of this. But he wasn't too old, you know, for Lady Gregory to know that he had to be fully protected. He was like a child in some ways. Like anyone having huge fame as a writer for the theatre becomes a hugely vulnerable person. Somehow or other, it's on at night. Mm. And they're your words. And they're being sort of said. And you're watching the crowd. You become both immensely proud and really brittle and vulnerable.
Your
and
audience
you go
are right
back,
there.
Yeah. You go back to being like a child. And anyone who's seen a young writer having quick fame, at the age of Andy Love, doesn't matter. He becomes a very brittle, difficult person and oddly lovable, needing protection and very bad if crossed.
Because and the other thing, of course, is Yeats and Lady Gregory have a lot of experience in this kind of struggle for artistic freedom. It goes back to the Playboy riots. It goes back to when they staged Shaw's The Showing Up of Blanco Posnet. Because it had been banned in England, they chose to stage it in Ireland.
That was 2 years after the Playboy.
That's just after, yeah. So they have a history of this. I mean, Lady Gregory says, this is our first great fight of the Free State.
But they do entertain O'Brien's his critiques to some extent. I mean, there's a song that's cut from the end of Act One, isn't it? A bawdy song.
I mean, it has to be said that Lady Gregory was a really admirable person. In other words, that she was not a firebrand. All through, she had kept peace in certain ways while also having her way. And she realised in this situation, she didn't want to fight with the government on this. She didn't want to fight with George O'Brien. So she made compromises while keeping O'Casey sweet. She really behaved superbly throughout all of this. She was absolutely intent on getting the play on and absolutely intent also in not having a big fight with either O'Brien or the government, or on the other hand, with O'Casey. She was a really calm, interesting figure, but she believed fundamentally in the freedom to put this on and in the fact that this new state needed to know this. Mm. And it knows emphatically that if it couldn't put on this, then what had people been fighting for? What had Home Rule battle been for? What had the Rising been for? If not for the right of O'Casey to put on this play. She really believed that. And oddly, no one, Yeats did, but hardly anybody else did.
Mm.
And when it came up that the subsidy could be in danger and George O'Brien was on the board, really representing the government, she said to him, if it's a choice between the subsidy and our freedom, we will always take our freedom.
I think that's right. And I think if it hadn't been this play, it would have been something else. That there was a felt need to make a stand, to say, you know, freedom is artistic freedom.
Let's come to the events of the week then, because I mean, the opening night was a great success. The first few nights, then there were some very quiet disturbances. Then we get to the Thursday night.
Mm.
Chris Morrish, what happens? What sets things off?
Well, it was planned. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things about these riots is that as riots go, they weren't terribly destructive. That, you know, you have a theatre that had you know, chandeliers, it had paintings, it had a lot of really nicely breakable stuff. And these riots didn't really destroy things. The main organisers of the protest were the women of Cumann na Mban, and you know, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington particularly, but she brought along Pádraic Pearse's mother, she'd brought along Thomas Clark's widow. There were a whole series, the women of 1916, if you like. They were very experienced protesters. For instance, the previous month, they had protested at a film that was about the First World War, where the British Army were presented as being sort of very heroic, and they had actually broken up things in the cinema. They had protest in the cinema and caused the film to be withdrawn.
Same women coming up.
The same women, yeah. And they were very good at using articles of female clothing that couldn't be, just simply taken from them as weapons. Things like shoes with big heel. That's the reason shoes were thrown. You think of the shoe styles in the 1920s. One of the lines in the play, they talk about Cuban heels. These big Cuban heels were ferocious weapons. Hat pins. They were very good at using these kind of articles of female clothing. So they were experienced agitators.
Mm-hmm. We can hear now from somebody who was there on the night, Gabriel Fallon, an actor a lifelong friend of O'Casey, played Captain Brennan in that first production of The Plough and the Stars. And this is a clip from the RTE archive from 1964.
When Yeats arrived, that one would expect the director of the theatre to be rather perturbed. His face was smiling. He was absolutely delighted. You could see that. And he was even more delighted that to help him unintentionally, Dolan had ordered the curtain to come down, which I think was a mistake. The actor should have played on. Yeats, the greatest actor on the stage that night was Yeats. He was absolutely marvellous. His behaviour was like that of an emperor rebuking slaves. We heard that he was on his way. He'd called into the Irish Times. Now, who gave him the message there that there was trouble in the Abbey Theatre, I don't know, but he was on his way down to the Abbey Theatre.
Contabine, W.B. Yeats's role on the night, I mean, he made one of those speeches that's quoted everywhere. Tell me about that.
I find it really emotional and, it really matters to me, that speech and how he organised it. I know the rhetoric is a bit high and I know that no one could hear him, and I know he went to the Irish Times to make sure it was in the paper the next day. But he gave me a country, you know. In other words, within a few years, they're going to bring in censorship and censor all the books. And there were years, dark years for writers and disgraceful years for readers. And what Yeats was proposing that night, that actually we cannot go on doing this, was something that actually mattered. And is for me really, I know it's ridiculous, but it's also inspiring.
Did O'Casey respect him for it?
Look, he called O'Casey Casey. Now, like, it's simple as that. He called him Casey even in writing. He didn't just address him as Casey. In letters, he would write, "Dear Casey." He viewed him as a very low form of life, and he had no respect for his work. And O'Casey watched all this. It was a mixture of bitterness and amusement.
Really, after the riots 20 years earlier at the Playboy of the Western World, they sort of knitted it all together at the end with a debate. Mm. What happened with the Plough and the Stars?
Lady Gregory understood that she was dealing with a more formidable enemy this time. That at the time of the Playboy, that you could actually have a debate. And it could be almost a debate about the future of Ireland, and you could get everybody in. And this time, however, these women were, as you say, formidable and experienced, but also very difficult to debate against, because you were talking almost about their grief, and almost if you brought them in together, you could not defeat them. In other words, all they would have to do is stand up, and there was something like Greek theatre, the silence of them as a chorus, and no words or no rational debate would defeat them. And Yeats, of course, longed for a debate because he had lovely ties to wear and, you know, his floppy hair and stuff. And Lady Gregory understood that in this new state, these women had a very funny sort of controlling power and you wouldn't prevail.
But a debate did happen.
Well, it was organised in the Republican Club. And
nothing to do with the Abbey itself.
No, the Abbey
wasn't
didn't
on
work,
the Abbey
no,
stage.
It wasn't on the Abbey stage, as happened, say, with the Playboy riots. So it was organised separately. And it was basically Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and O'Casey. And O'Casey prepared a lot for it. I mean, the notes are still there. He wrote, quite a vigorous defence, and there had been an exchange of letters between himself and Hannah Shee Skeffington in the newspapers, where she, you know, she asked, you know, did he think he was really remembering the men of 1916 correctly? And he responded with, you know, the great line, he said, you know, are there the hordes of people who are streaming to the cinemas and to the football matches, you know, remembering the men of 1916 with tear-dimmed eyes? He was saying, look, we've moved on. And the night of the debate, he was ready to really defend himself, and he seems to have just collapsed. She stood up, she made a very eloquent speech. He then stood up and sat back down again. You know, his eyes were bothering him at the time, but he just... And then he did stand up and speak, but he does not seem to have really made an impact.
He had been fond of her husband, hadn't he?
Frances Shee Skeffington was a pacifist and a vegetarian and a man who, at the time of the Easter Rising, went out to stop people looting, because he believed that if reports of looting got around, it would sully what had happened. And he was taken prisoner, and he was subsequently executed by a British Army officer who was subsequently found to be insane. So Hannah Shee Skeffington was in a curious sort of situation in that
she's going to a play then in which O'Casey is depicting the rioters almost as heroes.
Yes, that's right.
It's
a serious problem for him. But there's an irony there, because as Colm says, in O'Casey's History of the Irish Citizen Army, Frances Shee Skeffington is the hero.
Colm, you reimagined that whole debate in your play, Beauty in a Broken Place. What happened? What do you think happened?
I thought it was emotional. In other words, it was already, as you say, he had done all the work. He was absolutely ready to defend himself. And you know, he was bitter and he was angry and he was proud. And he was articulate and he was brilliant in many ways. But this was too much. Somehow or other, the idea of making this argument against someone whose, you know, husband he'd admired, who had lost her husband, and the sort of anger all around, and just simply the words failed him and he sat down. And I think even though, you know, it was after that he talked about leaving the country and all the business of after the Silver Tassie, but I think it was around that time that suddenly Ireland became for him a place that he couldn't deal with any further.
Well, let's hear something from your play now. This is the scene where Hannah Shee Skeffington debates Sean O'Casey after the play.
I am one of those who have gone for over 20 years to performances at the Abbey. This same Abbey, built on high ideals and immense talent and hard work that helped to make Easter Week, is now, in its subsidised, sleek old age, ready to jeer and sneer at its former enthusiasms.
Couldn't take their eyes off her. Whatever she found in herself that night, she meant what she said, and she had nothing to gain. And I forgot my eyes, which stung all that week, and I forgot my hatred for her. I just looked at her and listened. And that's what everyone else in the hall did too.
The women of Easter Week were not like Nora Clitheroe, just as her futile, snivelling husband is not typical of Irish manhood. The women of Easter, as we know them, are typified rather in the mother of Patrick Pearse, that valiant woman who gave both of her sons for freedom. They shall be remembered forever, while the garrison mentality in the Abbey Theatre, which calls the police nightly, will be soon forgotten.
All the heart was in every line she said, and I felt then that whatever she thought and whatever I wrote, it was the women left after the Rising who suffered the most. And she was one of them, and their memory was precious, just as their fear and their love had once merged into a terror and a grief, which were written into every word they spoke and breath they managed, and every line on their faces. The two of us looked at each other for a few seconds as we recognised that fact in all its... And then she turned away and we went home.
That was Carl Shields as Sean O'Casey and Dervla Crotty as Hannah Shee Skeffington. Chris Morash.
There's a great Hannah Shee Skeffington story, of course, of the day after the riots. And she was at home and she was going out to the theatre to another play in the Gaiety, going to see a play called Lightning. And her son, Owen, said to her, you know, just be careful. There was a big party in Trinity last night, so there might be some drunken students around. And with a completely straight face, she said, oh, I hope not. If there's one thing I really hate, it's rowdyism in the theatre.
Colm Tobin, Hannah Shee Skeffington, she refers to the Abbey in its subsidised, sleek old age. But already it's being jeered for taking the subsidy and for being a valetudinarian theatre.
Yes, it's always been easy to jeer the Abbey. But I think again and again in those years, from, say, 1900 until the foundation of the state, it was a place you could go in Ireland where Irish things were happening, where Irish actors were performing. It was not a provincial stage where touring companies were coming like to Birmingham or Liverpool, but it gave Ireland something great and serious. And there were plays put on all the time of different sorts and actors used and different you know, scenery. And I mean, there was a seriousness about it. And it mattered to enormous numbers of people who were serious in Dublin, such as Hannah Shee Skeffington. It really represented some extraordinary ideal of what an independent country could be like in its emerging years.
Mm. And I think there's something that Colm, implicit in what Colm's saying there, that's very important here, and that is people riot in a theatre because they love that theatre, that they feel it is their place. And that's true of theatre riots right through history. You know, one of the most vigorous theatre riots of the 19th century were the old Price riots in the theatres in London, where the price of tickets were put up, and people rioted because that was their place. And the people who rioted in the Abbey were people who really loved the Abbey and loved the idea of what it stood for. But it was more than they're paying for it. It's a sense of ownership, that it's a kind of public space. In some ways, while I wouldn't advocate rioting in theatres, rioting in a theatre is paying a compliment to theatre, that this is a serious place. This is a place where serious ideas are being discussed, performed.
The Abbey as a public space, as a space that not just a public, not a space that's open to the public, but a space that's owned by the public. Do we have that sense still today, do you think?
In my lifetime you do. There were nights there when Tom Murphy's The Geely concert went on, where something miraculous happened on the stage, when Brian Friel's Faith Healer went on. And these were not really telling national stories, but they were telling national metaphors in some way or other. In some way or other they hit us, all of us, as though this is searingly important, whatever's going on here. And there's a sense of excellence, a sense of brilliance in the way the lighting, the design, the acting, the level of seriousness. And also, when Observe the Sons of Ulster, Marching Towards the Sun, went on in the Peacock Theatre, where something really important was being said, and said almost metaphorically about our relationship to Protestants in Northern Ireland and some in that tradition. When Sebastian Barry's Prayers of Shirkin went on, when those sort of plays went on in the theatre, something happened, and it wasn't merely one was being entertained or it was nice, it was bloody important. I have a lot of hope for it over the next decade, in the belief in new writing that's still there, the belief, the literary department, the sort of commitment that the actors who go in there to work have, and the sort of overall vision that the artistic director has, and the sense also of a rawness in the outside world, of a hunger for images, of a need for something. And I know that, say, in the next 12 months or next 2 years, there are new plays coming. And I'm very interested, at some point or other, the spot will be hit. In other words, that something will rise in the theatre in the next few years, and that it's as likely to happen there as anywhere, in the sense that actors still love working there. There's a sense of tradition and importance about being on that stage. Writers love having their work on there. It doesn't mean that everything works, that everything's perfect, but there is still that sense. It's a funny old thing and it's hard to define. And there are times when the audience feels it. So it's not impossible. It's not as though, oh, the glory days are over and it'll never happen again. I don't think that's true.
Well, the next programme will again feature Gardaí and protests at the theatre, outrage amongst the public and the threat of censorship. Except this time, the Gardaí will arrest the director and the protests will be directed against the Gardaí. And at the centre of it all, a non-existent condom. This is the curious case of the Rose Tattoo. And we'll be discussing it in the third programme in this series, From Stage to Street. My thanks to Chris Morash and Colm Jabin for joining me in studio this week. Join us then.
From Stage to Street was presented by Colin Murphy and produced by the late Peter Mooney. The opening montage was by Simon Kenny and research was by Barry Houlihan. The programme featured the voices of actors Carl Shields, Derva Lacrotti and Joe Taylor. The programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m. rte.ie/drama on One.
Drama on One.